from the watchmen of ancient cities to the rise of modern police forces, and from medieval dungeons to today's correctional institutions, our systems of law enforcement and punishment have shaped societies for centuries. Welcome to Silver and Blue, tracing the history of policing and corrections, the podcast where we will uncover the beginning to the present of policing and corrections. Each episode, we'll explore how justice was enforced, how punishment evolved, and what these legacies mean for us today. Let's step back in time and see how order and disorder came to be. Hello, and welcome to the very first episode of Silver and Blue. I'm so glad you could join me. For our first episode, we'll start by traveling thousands of years into the past to where archaeology and tradition give us some of the earliest evidence of law and justice in ancient times. Once that foundation is down, we will move to the civilizations that are often named as the firsts of law and justice. The first we will visit is the birthplace of civilization itself, Mesopotamia. Before there were distinct civilizations, there were tribal communities that dated back to prehistoric times. And while the peoples from this timeline did not write, the archaeological evidence can explain some things about how they handled disputes and conflicts between individuals and other communities. What we do know about this time period is that oral tradition was the way that norms were shared within the tribe. With that, the importance of the tribe was conveyed and the survival of the tribe was communicated. If that was violated, there were elders that were then in place to handle the disputes. But when it came to tribes and resolution of conflicts and the norms of their time, they relied predominantly on what we would recognize today as restorative justice. The ultimate goal was to keep the tribe together through such things as mediation, negotiation, compensation from the offender, or ritual reconciliation like gift exchanges or ceremonies that expressed forgiveness. Tribes were also not above public shaming, since then as in now, public opinion matters. Serious matters could result in exile or expulsion, which would be a last resort and as close to a death sentence as there was for this time. That is because for a single tribe member to be left behind or told to leave would leave him with no support, supplies, and at the mercy of predators, weather, or whatever you can think of. Eventually, tribes evolved into what we would now recognize as civilizations and early society. And this leads us to where we will concentrate the rest of this episode, Mesopotamia. This is where humans first built cities, first developed writing, and crucially for us, first created written laws. If you've ever wondered where ideas like contracts, courts, police, or even the concept of justice itself began, Mesopotamia is where the trail leads. So today we will learn and discuss what the structure of Mesopotamian society was, what the world's earliest legal codes were, how policing and enforcement first took shape that long ago, what justice meant to people that lived 4,000 years ago, and how those ancient choices still echo through our modern laws today. So let's say we dive in. We're going to embark on a journey that started 4,000 years ago. In a time with clay tablets, kings, and the earliest attempts to answer a question we still struggle with today. How do we create a just society? Let's imagine what the landscape of this time looked like. Mesopotamia means the land between the rivers. In this case, the Tigris and the Euphrates. If you look at a map of the world, this region, now in modern-day Iraq and parts of Syria and Turkey, was home to some of the earliest cities in human history. Uruk, Lagash, Nippur, and probably the best known to us, Babylon. As people settled in these areas, by around 3000 BCE, these weren't just villages. They were bustling urban areas, with things like temples that towered high in the sky, palaces that were expansive and grand, markets bustling daily with trade, bureaucracies, schools, and thousands upon thousands of people. When you think about how complex these new urban areas became, there were going to be challenges and questions that would need answers. Questions that we would find simple today, but weren't in those times. Questions like, who owned what? Who owned what to who? And who was responsible when things went wrong? With this realization that this new urban life demanded order, Mesopotamia became the birthplace of administration, record-keeping, and eventually law. So you're thinking, I'm sure, why Mesopotamia? Well, the region's geography played a huge role. The rivers, remember it's the Tigris and Euphrates, flooded unpredictably, which meant cooperation was needed for irrigation systems that needed to be built, labor that had to be coordinated, and distribution of the land that they now controlled. This required central authority, or, as we would equate it now, government. And once you have that central authority, well, you need rules to govern how that works. When students in my criminal justice classes, or possibly history classes, look into the first codified laws and who or how they came into being, the assumption is that it all begins with King Hammurabi. But the truth is way cooler. It begins with the Code of Ur-Nammu. And he reigned from 2100 to 2050 BCE. This is the earliest known legal code we have. It predates Hammurabi by about four centuries. Ur-Nammu's laws governed assault, marriage and divorce, bodily injury, and protections for widows and orphans. And while we will talk more about punishment in the future, one thing that I think is surprising is that many punishments were monetary fines, not physical retaliation. This suggests a society seeing itself as establishing a society through compensation rather than vengeance. Well, next we have the reforms of Uru-Kagina, about 2350 BCE. At least two centuries before Ur-Nammu, the ruler of Uru-Kagina of Lagash issued reforms aimed at reducing corruption and protecting the poor from exploitation by elites and temple officials. He claimed to have established freedom for the people of Lagash, one of the earliest uses of the concept of freedom in recorded history. In other words, a world not just by kings, but by law. So now we are going to talk about probably the best known of Mesopotamian legal history, Hammurabi, who was king of Babylon, who ruled around 792 to 750 BCE. His legal code, nearly 300 laws carved onto a massive stone steel, is one of the most iconic artifacts in the ancient world. And while Hammurabi's code wasn't the first, it was the most comprehensive, and it served several purposes. It portrayed Hammurabi as a just ruler chosen by the gods, which provided legitimacy to his rule. It standardized legal expectations across his empire, which solidified his authority in Babylon, and the stone steel was displayed publicly so citizens could see the laws and thereby not question as to the expectations of society. In establishing this code, writing it down, and displaying it publicly, Hammurabi standardized legal expectations and presented himself as ultimately seen by his people, a ruler that was chosen by the gods. So, let's take a look at some of the laws that these stone tablets covered. If this is the first time that you're hearing about Hammurabi, then you might be surprised to know that the code written almost 4,000 years ago had laws on theft, contracts, marriage and divorce, wages, medical malpractice, assault, property disputes, slavery, and agriculture. And while anybody who's taken a criminal justice course knows that Hammurabi's law was notoriously harsh, but he is also known for writing some of the first nuanced and fair laws for a society. For example, if a builder constructed a house that collapsed and killed the owner, the builder could be executed. Harsh, I know. But if the collapse only damaged property, well, then the builder only had to repair it at his own expense. This is an early sign of liability law. Also, Hammurabi and the Babylon society established law and social class. That's the one thing we do have to remember with this particular society, is that these laws were written at a time when social class were definitely taken into consideration when these laws were enacted. So there were three classes of people. There were the free citizens, dependents, and enslaved people. Punishments varied by class. So back 4,000 years ago, especially in Babylon, this tells us that law was deeply tied to social hierarchy. Next up, we're going to move to something that people probably don't realize when they're thinking about ancient civilizations. Mesopotamia had policing. Well, not policing in the modern sense, but institutions and officials responsible for maintaining order. So if we take a few moments to look at what the first steps of ancient policing was, let's start with, well, what they were and what they did. They were called the Sabra and the Nubanda. These were high-ranking officials whose job it was to supervise labor, enforce royal decrees, and oversee public works. Next were the temple officials. Back in ancient Mesopotamia and Babylon, temples weren't just religious centers. They were administrative hubs with their own enforcement personnel. They were responsible for things like performing or assisting in religious rituals, like purification rituals. They were responsible for distributing rations to the population, collecting taxes. But they were also responsible for overseeing contracts, organizing public works, and participating in legal matters. One big thing about ancient civilizations is they were very heavy into community enforcement. And since there was no formal enforcement, ancient civilizations relied on families and neighborhoods to report crime, help identify suspects, and participate in investigations. This was some of the earliest examples of collective responsibilities. Now, if we're looking at some of the ways that the civilization looked at guilt or innocence, this was determined by something called the river ordeal. The accused would be thrown in a river, and if they survived, well, then the gods had judged that they were innocent. If they drowned, well, the gods had spoken in another way. I know that sounds bizarre today, but it reflects that at that time, the world view was divine judgment was part of the legal procedure. As we mentioned, police reports were taken on clay tablets, just like the law code was. And archaeologists have found clay tablets from cities like Mari and Nippur that have included actual reports of theft, patrol logs, witness statements, and investigative notes. These are some of the earliest bureaucratic records of law enforcement anywhere in the world. In ancient times, it was not uncommon to have a legal procedure that extended off of the form of policing we just discussed. Mesopotamian courts were surprisingly sophisticated. The judges were the people that served in that role in ancient Mesopotamia. They were often the elders, people who had the most respect and were typically nobility in society, temple priests who also served as judges depending on their rank, and royal officials who typically served the king or were a ruler in their court or administration. These people were expected to interpret laws, hear testimony, and issue rulings, much as our modern-day judges do today. Some of the common crimes that were policed during this time: theft, which was a major concern, especially because the civilization relied a lot on agriculture, so theft of agricultural goods was extremely concerning. Assault. Assault laws were very detailed. Penalties depended on, well, the injury. Would the injury hinder the victim from supporting his family? What if the victim was female or a child? Remember, the social status of the victim, as we will continually come back to in future episodes, social status was an important and decisive matter and very influential in criminal cases, including assault. Here's a thought. Do you think that still holds true today? And the circumstances. How did the assault come about? Another crime and concern was family law. Marriage was a legal contract. And during this civilization, divorce was allowed, but very regulated. Women had rights, but those rights varied by class. One thing we have to remember in these ancient civilizations is that slavery existed, but enslaved people had some legal protections, including the right to buy their freedom. We may look at this in another episode in the context of what crimes were unique to enslaved persons in this time, and punishment if it was more or less severe. And there were also economic crimes, much like we have today. Interest rates, loans, and debt were tightly regulated. Debt slavery was a constant issue, and some kings issued clean slate decrees to free debtors. Imagine that. Mesopotamia was one of the first recorded civilizations. Because of this, their law wasn't just about rules. It reflected a world view for this time. And this world view included law as divine order. This time was ruled by kings and high rulers. Kings like Ur-Nammu and Hammurabi claimed the gods appointed them to maintain justice. Law as social control. The legal system reinforced hierarchy. As mentioned previously, social class was an integral part of society. The legal system was the way they used that enabled them to keep the system in place. We have now looked at how ancient civilization has influenced societies that came after them all the way to modern day. So why am I talking about what happened 4,000 years ago? Does it even matter? I ask in many ways that we tend to forget. Because Mesopotamia represents the first time humans tried to formalize justice, to write it down, preserve it, and apply it systematically, it's the birthplace of written law, legal procedure, policing, contracts, courts, and bureaucracy. As we bring this episode to a close, let's think to ourselves. While their world was very different from ours, the questions they asked are still questions we ask to this day. How do we balance fairness with order? How do we protect the vulnerable? How do we limit the powerful? How do we create a society where justice prevails? If you are curious about Hammurabi's code and what it looks like, there are several ways to view it. Pictures are on social media platforms like Google and YouTube. However, to see it in person, you can go to the Louvre Museum in Paris. There is an exhibit of the actual code for viewing. I plan to see that one day myself. That wraps up today's episode of Silver and Blue, tracing the history of policing and corrections. This podcast is produced by LCC Connect. You can listen to other podcasts in the LCC Connect family by going to lccconnect.com. If you want to listen to this podcast on demand, go to lccconnect.com and visit the Silver and Blue webpage. Until next time, keep questioning, keep learning, and keep the dialogue alive.
Ex- examining the issues and topics that affect our lives from the local level to the world stage. Listen to the programs of LCC Connect anytime at lccconnect.org.
LCC
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
The stage is alive and well at Lansing Community College. Each year, the downtown campus comes to life with more than 30 performances at Dart Auditorium, the Black Box Theater, and LCC's Outdoor Amphitheater. These productions are more than entertainment. They're part of the learning experience. Students in LCC's Performing Arts program gain hands-on experience, both on stage and behind the scenes, developing confidence, creativity, and collaboration. From powerful plays to lively concerts, LCC's performances celebrate local talent and the vibrant spirit of the arts in our community. All performances are free. Find out what's next at lcc.edu/showinfo.
Hi, I'm Lisa Alexander, and I host a show called Who's That Star on LCC Connect. This show is all about an inside look at the LCC community, where you get a chance to meet our faculty and staff, plus learn about their passion projects at work and at home. You can catch Who's That Star here on LCC Connect or listen anytime at lccconnect.org.
If you or someone you know lives with epilepsy, be aware of an uncommon but fatal complication called sudden unexpected death in epilepsy, also known as SUDEP. It is the sudden unexpected death of a person with epilepsy who is otherwise healthy. Each year, SUDEP kills 1 in 1,000 adults with epilepsy and 1 in 4,500 children with epilepsy. The American Academy of Neurology and the American Epilepsy Society have released a new medical guideline to help patients, families, and caregivers better understand SUDEP and its risk factors. A high risk factor is generalized tonic-clonic seizures that involve the entire body. The guideline shows that reducing the number of tonic-clonic seizures could lower the risk of SUDEP. If you have epilepsy, it is important that you talk with your neurologist. To learn more about SUDEP, visit aan.com/guidelines. That's aan.com/guidelines.
Returning to school can be a challenge. If you're a recent high school grad, a new Michigan Reconnect participant at LCC, or a GED holder, we want to help you succeed with extra support in reading, writing, and math. LCC's Coalition for College and Career Readiness presents College Connect, a four-week, no-cost initiative created to prepare students with the tools needed to succeed at LCC. College Connect begins in July, but seating is limited. To find deadline and enrollment information, visit lcc.edu/cc.
LCC.
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
Conversations with Kate is like a conversation with your friend, hairstylist, or therapist, where we will talk about music, life, stories, and everything in between, with interviews and guests sprinkled in. I am your host, Kate. Let's get into this episode. All right. Welcome, and thank you so much for pressing play and joining me for this episode. We're going to talk about my biggest lesson of 2025, grace. Grace for myself, grace for life, grace for people. It happened through the loss of about 8 people in 2025. Friends, loved ones, and that was also ended by the death of my mother and then my younger brother. And it was definitely a lot, but also I know the sting was there more so with my brother passing away on December 22nd. And it's okay that there is a little bit of weight and heaviness to that situation. Going back to the lesson, the carrying grace forward through the rest of my life, it definitely, having all of those people pass away and then my mother pass away and then my brother pass away, I have this exponentially more forgiving and more present view of grace giving people grace for whatever emotions they're going through, however they're behaving, and however they're processing things. Because we're all human. We're literally here going through this human experience. And I didn't really think, I thought I had a pretty good like grasp on like how people are and the life view and that type of thing. And then it wasn't until after my mother passed away that I was like, oh, okay. Now I just have that deeper understanding of having grace for people and situations and myself. And it just has made life a little more, believe it or not, effortless to go through, because it's not always, you know, silver lining rainbows and sparkly stuff. I've learned not to focus on a tragedy, but to more explore the unexpected grace, compassion, and clarity that came from it, which is a really nice lesson to have in my tool belt now. Specifically, what it revealed about being human, that grief is an equalizer. It literally strips life down to the essentials and reshapes priorities. The surprising places that I found strength, that I've watched people go through things, which again, it just gives me that little bit more bit of grace for other people as they go through things, and just like, okay, well, what can I do to help support you through whatever it is that you're going through? And again, grief truly is the great equalizer. It really exposes what is the most important. Going through all of this, it definitely gave me more grace for myself, that I don't follow a timeline anymore. I'm not super strict on, you know, if I, you know, miss this thing or that thing, or it's more of a fluid way through life now, where before it was like everything had to be just so and everything had to be perfect and regimented and very rigid, where now it's just like, okay, you know, being okay with not being okay, but also with things not being in a straight line and not happening the way that, you know, I pre-planned them. Oh, which again, being a Taurus and being someone who has ADD, regiment and perfection and patterns and all of that is super duper important to me. So I really am thankful that I now have this immense grace for myself. So not to be perfect, and that's okay. Stumbling is all right. Just kind of like that saying goes, like just kind of make it part of the, you know, dance or part of the walk. I definitely feel now that grace for myself. I am way more resilient, and I see the resilience in other people as well. I love seeing the messiness in things, where I used to be super duper OCD when I was younger. And even prior to this past year, so much so as like, you know, don't get me wrong, I still like to do my cleaning on a certain day and that type of thing. But there's just much more grace for myself if I don't get it done on Sunday first thing in the morning, and if there's not the vacuum lines in the carpet. I definitely have a lot more grace for others. How specifically the grace has softened my expectation of other people, that whether they're going through something really terrible, like the loss of a human being in their lives, or they're just going through a stressful time, they have anxiety, they have depression, it's softened me in a way and given me that grace for other people in that way as well. I understand that everyone is carrying something that's unseen, like we talked about in a previous podcast. There's so much more grace for understanding that. It means a completely different thing. And I realize that, and have compassion for matters that are more than we can talk about. And I have a little bit more grace for that. Not a little bit, a whole bunch more grace for other people that sometimes there's just not really anything that you can say or do. And you kind of just have to be there for people and understand that sometimes it's going to be messy, and that's okay. And I really, again, I just, that was my lesson, is that the grace that I have for other people, even in the community. There were some things that happened in my community recently where in years past, I would have felt some type of way about the way that the community and people had reacted. And with this thing that happened, it was more of just like, I understand. I understand why people reacted the way that they did. And again, I just can't reiterate enough the sentiment that it has just made the tough stuff easier to get through, and to watch people go through and to be supportive of people. Again, that the grace, the word grace for myself and grace for every situation, and patience. It's an amazing shift in perspective. Specifically, what losing my mom taught me was that you don't know when things are going to happen. Like, we knew that she was in the hospital. We knew that she was, you know, not in the best of health, but she also had a great perspective from the doctor of, here, you're gonna get better. And she didn't, unfortunately. But same thing with my brother. He was like, okay, this is one thing that's going on. We're gonna make it through. And then he did not. Again, both of those situations taught me that you never know. So make sure that you leave every single person that you care about, that you love, with a great exchange. And even if you're having a tough conversation, like, give the other person and yourself enough grace in that situation to be like, okay, I know that this tough conversation had to happen, but I love you so much and I can't wait to see you again. So that is one thing that those, both of the deaths of my mother and my brother, have taught me, is that memories are what matter, and telling those people that you love is what matters. And that huge shift in perspective, my sense of what truly matters definitely changed. It shifted from being perfect and achieving to having so much more grace for every situation that we go through as human beings, enjoying and savoring every situation that we go through as human beings, and giving every single person grace as they go through every single situation that they go through, whether it is an elated celebration or a tough stuff type of thing. I definitely say no way more freely. I say I love you more often. And I savor small moments way more every single day now. Conversations with important people, the clients that I have, the friends that I have, the family that I have, make it a point to connect with all of those people. And again, just savor those special little moments, even if it's something as simple as, like, for instance, my friend Victoria started doing a once a month get together where we all go to her house and have dinner. And it's a bunch of different people from her life that she invited to these things. And I'm really looking forward to the next one. I'm recording this in February. So the next one is a chili cook-off. But yeah, so just enjoying that connection and savoring those little small everyday moments. I also go, like, at least once a week with her and do yoga in the morning for about 30 minutes. So that's another thing that I savor. I have a renewed sense of desire to connect deeply, more deeply with people. Like, for instance, my daughter and I, we flitted off to Miami for about 36 hours to just have a mom and daughter moment. And it was so great. We literally flew in on a Friday night, got there late Friday night, early Saturday morning, spent the day shopping at Lincoln Road Mall, went to the beach, and then spent the rest of the evening by the pool, and then got up and flew home to Michigan. Some ways that this has altered my DNA. Given me grace as spaciousness, allowing life to be imperfect, grace as acceptance. I realize I have to release what I can't control. And man, that lesson right there was important. And I'm glad for it. Grace as connection, recognizing how relationships carry us through the darkness. And grace as softness, speaking more kindly to myself and others. I do have an invitation for you guys to reflect on. Where are you finding grace right now? Who do you need to extend softness to, including yourself? I just want to give you gentle encouragement. Healing isn't linear, and having grace isn't always easy, but that connection helps. Thank you so much for listening to this episode about the shift in perspective that I had on giving myself and everyone and every situation grace.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Conversations with Kate. You can find more information on LCC Connect site, as well as all social platforms, Facebook, Instagram, yes, TikTok as well. Big love.
Featuring the faculty, staff, students, and others that helped to make Lansing's premier college what it is today. LCC Connect, Mid-Michigan's connection to Lansing Community College. To find out more about our featured programs or to listen on demand, visit us at lccconnect.org.
LCC Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
LCC Library empowers the Lansing community to learn, teach, and discover. Located on the second and third floors of the Technology and Learning Center at the corner of Capitol and Shiawassee on LCC's downtown campus, the LCC Library's ambient spaces are available to the public for work, study, or quiet personal projects. In addition, those with memberships at collaborating libraries are free to check out materials from the LCC Library's collections. For more information, visit lcc.edu/library.
Feeling froggy? Well, leap into 20-plus podcasts at lccconnect.org.
LCC Alumni Stories, a show dedicated to highlighting the amazing alumni of Lansing Community College. I'm Steve Robinson, president of LCC, and on each episode, I have the awesome privilege of getting to know one of our many inspiring alums and hearing about their experiences at and since leaving LCC.
Listen to this program and many others on demand at lccconnect.org.
Today in school, I learned a lot. In chemistry, I learned that no one likes me. In English, I learned that I'm disgusting. And in physics, I learned that I'm a loser.
Today in school, I learned that I'm ugly and useless. And in gym, I learned that I'm pathetic and a joke. In history, I learned that I'm trash.
Today in school, I learned that I have no friends. In English, I learned that I make people sick. And at lunch, I learned that I sit on my own because I smell. In chemistry, I learned that no one likes
me. In biology, I learned that I'm fat and stupid. And in math, I learned that I'm trash.
The only thing I didn't learn in school today...
The only thing I didn't learn...
is why no one ever helps.
Kids witness bullying every day. They want to help, but they don't know how. Teach them how to stop bullying and be more than a bystander at stopbullying.gov. A message from the Ad Council.
A 7-week job training opportunity is now enrolling, and many can participate tuition-free. Those who have graduated from high school within the last 5 years can attend the Electrical Control Technician Boot Camp at no cost, thanks to grants from the Michigan Department of Economic Development. Those interested in the Electrical Control Technician Boot Camp provided by the LCC Job Training Center can learn more at lcc.edu/JTC.
LCC.
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
Hello, friends, and welcome to Coach Cuts Corner.
Streaming bright from Michigan's capital city, this podcast is dedicated to helping you better understand the who, the what, and the why of mental performance, personal growth, and Lansing Stars baseball. Coach Cuts Corner, brought to you by Eyewash.
In collaboration with Lansing Community College.
And now here's your host, Stephen Cutter.
Welcome back to Coach Cuts Corner. This is a place where we dive into stories, mindsets, and habits that drive athletes to be uncommon. Today, I'm sitting down with one of our own, sophomore outfielder Corbin Smith. Corbin brings a spark of energy to this team every single day. He's the kind of guy who can flip the mood of a dugout just with his presence. And while he's made a name for himself patrolling the outfield here at LCC, he's also earned a reputation for laying down arguably the straightest chalk lines in Stars history. That attention to detail says a lot about who he is. And today, we're going to dig into his journey, his mindset, and what makes Corbin tick. Welcome to the WLNZ studios, Corbin.
Thanks for having me.
I was wondering if you were ever going to get in here.
Yeah, me too.
Let's start at the beginning. Where'd your baseball journey start? And kind of twofolded, who were some of the people that, you know, kind of shaped you early on?
I started before I can even remember, honestly. It was T-ball back in, I think, when I was like three or four.
Makes sense.
And I played every sport you could think of growing up and just kind of always gravitated towards baseball. And my dad pushed me along that route a lot. So that's how I ended up here.
Did you ever play on an 8U nationally ranked team or anything like that?
No, I'm no Carson Sweet. So
solid memories. Did you play other sports besides baseball?
Yeah, I would say my main sports were baseball and football.
Okay. Did you play football in high school?
Yeah, I did. Started in fifth grade, I think, fourth or fifth grade. Right. And, I played flag football before that. So tackle football was fifth grade all the way up to my senior year.
Was there a moment that you kind of decided, like, yeah, I want to play baseball?
Yeah, it was kind of a whole bunch of things that led into me playing college baseball, because I could have played college football, but I didn't really want to deal with, because my dad played college football, and he said he doesn't want me to go through the same things that he did with like injuries and things like that. He says he still feels injuries to this day.
It's tough on your body, yeah, for sure. So I mean, if you think realistically just about playing college baseball,
it's
hard on your body. Yeah, but then you add a contact sport. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's probably times five or whatever. So yeah, it makes sense, and you've really got to love it to begin with. But yeah, it's going to be hard on your body. Kind of walk us through how you ended up here and what drew you to the program.
I would say I never really thought about going the JUCO route at first, you know, like coming up.
Why?
Because, you know, I always thought
the
like
stigma of it.
Not the stigma, but more or less just, I don't know, I'd always thought I would be at a big 4-year somewhere, but you know, sometimes it's not how things plan out. And then had other 4-year opportunities, but I didn't think any of them were up to the standard that I wanted to play at. And I knew here was an incredible program. So, and along with the mental side of things, I knew I needed to work on that. So,
yeah, I think everybody does.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, not everybody recognizes that they need to work on it, but everybody does need to work on it. And it doesn't matter if you play a sport or not. And that's kind of the cool part about your story, where you come from and what you brought here and some of the standards and the foundation of everything that you've done so far. I want to talk about kind of this thing with you that is energy / leadership. Because some of the stuff that I've seen this year, you're kind of known as one of our energy guys, not only in the dugout, but just going about a normal day. You're pretty happy, go lucky, you know, pretty much most of the time. What's that role mean to you, and how intentional are you about it, bringing great energy every day?
Yeah, well, I know that, you know, our schedule can get crazy, and especially with freshmen just now coming in, they, you know, they're not used to, especially once we get into winter and spring, like going 7 days a week, no one's ready for that. And having somebody that can, because I know I never really had this, having somebody that's always there and bringing up energy and asking you how you're doing, things like that, it can really just, it can change everything for you. It all depends on how you're feeling that day. If you're feeling bad, people can go to me to pick them up.
You know, we have a readiness test form that you guys fill out. Mm-hmm. The pitchers fill one out, and theirs is a little bit different than the position players. But on that readiness form, you're able to put, you know, kind of where your mental state is for the day.
Yeah.
Whether it's, you know, blue, meaning not so great, green, for pretty solid, and más o menos, which is basically means.
Does that mean like right in the middle?
Yeah. So. But the mental side is like super important, because we talk about when we do meditations to start practices and stuff like that, a big reason why we're doing those is just to really come back to being present. Because in your day, there's a lot that happens to everybody. There's just all kinds of things. And sometimes they're really not like huge things, but some of those things kind of stink a little bit, and you know, they're not ideal. And you know, then you're coming into a, you know, a couple hour practice, and you're supposed to be at 100%. You're supposed to be locked in and giving full effort. And if you don't understand how to separate that kind of stuff, well, that bleeds into practice. And then when that bleeds into practice, that bleeds into games, and that bleeds into playing time, and it bleeds into what type of teammate you are.
Yeah.
And those things. And I think you've done an incredible job this year just trying to be a leader, bring energy. You brought energy last year. The leadership piece, I think you showed signs of that last year too. Leadership is one of those things that you don't have to be a sophomore to lead.
Yeah.
Let's talk about strong teammates. Because when we talk about great teams that we've had at LCC, they've always had really strong teammates. So for you, what makes a strong teammate? And obviously we spoke last night at leadership. It's not just about talent, but the day-to-day stuff. What makes a strong teammate in your opinion?
I think what makes a strong teammate is someone that is going to show up every day. And, you know, no matter how they're feeling, they're always going to be there for their teammates. They're going to put 100% into whatever they're doing at that time. And, of course, you're not shading on teammates, things like that. You're not talking behind their back, nothing like that. You're always just trying to help them as a person and help the team ultimately to be better.
Yeah. Ultimately, I think you're trying your best to state the facts and speak the truth to your teammates. And it, sometimes that helps hold them accountable. Sometimes that helps pick them up, like when they feel like they're horrible or they need to redshirt or whatever it might be. And you can be like, yeah, you're actually doing pretty fine, you know, pretty solid. You might have had one bad game or something, but think about the big picture, you know, think about the last month or something like that. So that's kind of where like state the facts, speak the truth comes from. Yeah. It can be really helpful. And I think you're saying it best, where it's like, you want to try to help them as much as they can. And because ultimately that's what you want too, right? I mean, that's what we all want. We want some people and that, to help us, and that's kind of what makes great teams and great environments. And what part of, like, when we talk about energy, where's that come from?
Great question. I would say,
because it's super contagious.
Yeah,
I would say, if you think about like bad energy, that's super contagious too. You got a whole room of people that are super negative.
Yeah,
you know, what do you think the whole room's going to be? You bring really solid energy.
Thank you.
So, like, where's that come from?
I would say it's the whole thing with, and me and Griffin were talking about this the other day. I think it was before the first practice, or no, before our first games this past weekend. We just couldn't wait to like get out there and just compete. The teams we played, we didn't get into a big jam there, but still just going out there and competing. I think if you don't have that like edge to you, if you don't have that want and like need to like compete, you're not going to have energy. And, but if you can go into that game and think, no matter what the scoreboard is, no matter how much we're up, how much we're down, we're just going to compete. And I think that's what drives me to really just go all out.
Yeah. you hit on something with saying like an edge, and the best teams, doesn't matter what sport it is, the best teams, they all have somewhat of an edge on when they're competing, and it looks a little bit different than maybe the average teams do.
100%.
Let's talk about those chalk lines a little bit. Where do those come from?
You know, I saw, I think it was Remick last year.
Okay.
I don't know. I saw him doing it, and I was super interested in it because, you know, over my, you know, many years of playing baseball, I've seen some pretty horrible lines. And that's always one of my biggest pet peeves, because you can always tell if a ball is fair or foul, but when there's a messed up line, like, it just looks bad too. You always want to play on a nice field. Yeah. I mean, that's...
Well, as I said at the intro, I think you've got some of the straightest lines in Stars baseball history. Of course, it's arguable, but it also, when I look at that, I think of like the things that we say often, like details matter. Mm-hmm. You and I can both think back to maybe it's the youth level or whatever, where somebody put lines down on the field and maybe didn't have enough time to put the lines down on the field, you know, so they just kind of made half moons and some of the things. And then, of course, in today's age, you know, when people show up to a field and they see some of that stuff, it gets shared and, you know, spread around. But yeah, like, details matter. You've done a great job with that piece of it and trying to lock into the details. I also think about, like, last year as a freshman, you were not the first one through the thank you knuckle line, but you were somewhere in the middle. And this year, you're kind of at the end. And one day I asked you, we're like 3 weeks in at this point, and one day I asked you, like, why are you always last? And what'd you say?
Well, we always, I mean, not always, but we have NTNC, you know. And I mean, I know that last year there's a bunch of times where we left balls out. And nobody was really going up and down the lines, checking balls and things for like things like that, things that were left out. And as a leader on the team, I feel as though it's my responsibility to make sure those things don't happen. And it's been better now because we spread the word to the freshmen and all my other teammates that if we do leave things out, we are going to run. And so I think making sure the field looks nice when we're done with it and
taking some pride. Yeah. And there's certainly some accountability that 100%. Just goes into it. You're asked to do whatever it might be. You got to make sure that you do whatever you're asked to do. And sometimes people need some help with that.
Yeah.
You know, and we have some accountability in our program. I think you guys have some extra MTNC today because a couple of people signed in late on their readiness tests, you know, and we had some failed.
Hope I didn't fail.
Failed tests last night, six of them, if I remember right. Those tests that we give in leadership, they're open journals. Mm-hmm. So if you're actually taking notes during and paying attention, they shouldn't be that hard. So there's certain pieces of accountability. I want to talk about like on-field development and growth as we transition forward in this podcast. From your perspective, what are some of your biggest strengths as an outfielder? What sets you apart?
Well, being an outfielder is one of the main things is speed. And I would say over the years, I kind of realized I transitioned from being an infielder to an outfielder when I was a sophomore in high school because I was talking to my high school coach and I was like, I kind of want to switch to outfield. And he was like, I could have told you this myself. He's like, you're one of the fastest guys on our team. Let's get you out there. I was like, okay. And then I would say last year, honestly, was a big year for me when it came to like developing in the outfield. And that was honestly just from watching Ryan, because I would be behind him taking reps and just watching his reads and things like that. I would say that's arguably just as important as speed, because you can have all the speed in the world. If you can't read a ball off the bat, then you're not going to catch anything.
Yeah. You say read, I think reaction.
Yeah.
You know, how, and then of course that ties into like the Pison readiness
big
test.
Time.
And we kind of showed you guys how much that correlates. What's a part of your game that you're kind of locked in on improving this season? Because we say like our fall season, it's for development. Mm-hmm. And that's not just a word we put on shirts or on the wall. Like we're trying to show this is for development.
Yeah, definitely my bat. I would say, you know, I have certain moments where I can shine for sure at the plate, but I want to be at the point where I'm not just being successful some of the time, it's most of the time.
Yeah.
As much as I can, at least, just being more consistent and doing my job at the plate as well. And that can be, for me, I think it's getting on base, taking second, taking third.
You want to talk about how much you love the eye pitch?
I mean, I would say it's probably one of my best friends.
Okay.
You know?
Just wanted to get that on.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a huge help because that thing is gross.
Yeah.
And
so we have a eye pitch machine and it basically is run off a tablet and, mm-hmm. you know, you can face some of the best pitchers in the game or you can face 85 with a four pitch mix. And
yeah.
you don't really know what's coming. And the mixes on the standard version of it, it's going to be the best changeup you've ever seen, or yeah. it's going to be the best slider you've ever seen.
Exactly.
It's got a filthy knuckleball.
Yeah.
And yeah, so it's not like a machine where you just feed the balls and you know what you just pretty much, fastball, you know, yeah. first round through, you've got a pretty solid idea what the tempo is, what your timing needs to be, and what the ball's doing coming out of that machine. With like the eye pitch, it's easier to train and we certainly use it to leverage to help our hitters not only get better, but get better on game days, things like that.
Yeah.
So that's kind of why I brought it up, because I know you love it. Do you have a favorite moment in your Stars uniform so far that sticks out to you?
Are you talking about in game?
Yeah, just favorite moment.
I don't think I have a favorite, like one moment, honestly. I would say last year, in general, it was incredible because we were an incredibly close team. And I would say like every time that we would put on the uniform and go out there, it honestly took all the stress out of it because you're just playing with your brothers. You know, we were so, it was the closest team I've ever been on. So just going out there and playing with them every day and just competing with them was
yeah.
the highlight of everything.
It's kind of like just enjoying the journey.
Yeah.
And you look at it as kind of one big thing and you're like, wow, it's a pretty cool journey.
Yeah.
You know,
it went by too fast.
So, man, it always does.
Yeah.
Always does. You've had some great experiences already. We've all had some great experiences from like last year's team. But what I like about you is how you've matured from your freshman to your sophomore year. So kind of going into, what's the biggest lesson you learned as a freshman that you're carrying into this year?
I think one of the biggest learning curves for me last year was realizing how lucky I am and lucky all of us are to be playing college baseball in general and playing for such an incredible program and being with such a close-knit group of guys and having all of the things that we have. It was really just realizing that you're here for a reason. Just go have fun.
Yeah. And I know you're a super genuine person and you're not saying that just try to get extra playing time or anything else. But if a brand new freshman, and which we've got a few of those in our program, asked you for advice on how to succeed in the Stars program, what would you tell them?
I've actually had this conversation with
I'm not shocked.
with a few guys already this year, and it kind of is a thing that a lot of them don't understand yet.
You don't know what you don't know.
I didn't know either. And, you know, I had guys tell me this last year as well. It really just comes down to, you say it all the time, buying in. There's going to be a ton of things that we do that when you're doing them, you're like, why are we doing this? And then as long as you buy in, it's all going to make sense at the end of the day. And it all comes together.
Yeah. The leadership piece is huge. But it's also the people listening to this, and the leadership piece on the field is huge too. It's not just in the dugout. It's on the field. It's at practices. It's in everything that you do.
Yeah.
Because like details matter and everything affects everything. Let's talk about game days a little bit. Kind of have a little bit of fun with this. Do you have a pregame routine?
Yeah.
Okay. What is it?
Well, I would
superstitions.
Say,
what you got going on?
I do have a superstition, but it's more once I get on the field.
Okay.
When I get on the field, if we're the home team, go out to the field, go out to center, wipe my feet in the dirt a little bit, say a prayer.
Hopefully, there's grass out there, not dirt. But
yeah. Well, you know the warning track.
Okay.
I go out to the warning track.
All right.
But before that, I listen to some music that a lot of people don't really like.
Okay.
but I listen to, you know, like rap music, things like that. Uh-huh. Yeah.
All right. So baseball's kind of been known to have traditions and superstitions for a long time. So it's kind of why that question comes up. What's something about you most of your teammates don't know? Should be fairly easy. We're only 3 weeks in.
Yeah. Something that they don't know. Try to be pretty open. I would say something they don't know about me is when it comes to games, I don't get nervous, really.
Okay. What do you get?
I just want to get out there. Like, at the end of the day, like during my warm-up, everything like that, all I'm thinking about is just playing. Like,
That's a power statement, saying you don't get nervous. I can appreciate that.
Yeah.
Everything is different for everybody. Mm. You know, some people, the night before, their stomach's rolling, and some people aren't. I want to do a couple quick hitters. Really haven't done this with our players that we have in here, and we try to bring some of our best players, and it's not always the guy that's leading the team in home runs or something like that, but like all-around leaders, best players, great teammates, things like that. So quick hitter for you. Favorite food?
Pasta.
Okay. Favorite music? I think you hit on that a little bit. Favorite baseball player growing up?
Ooh. So I used to wear number 14 my whole life for baseball. And that was because of Austin Jackson.
Oh, really?
From the Tigers. Yeah, crazy pull. I don't know. I remember watching the game where he made that catch over the fence, where he tumbled over the fence in center field. And that just made me love him.
Yeah. Jackson was pretty solid.
Yeah.
But I was more of a Don Kelly fan.
I don't know him.
Yeah, that's too bad. Too bad.
I'll look him up.
Corbin, you've had a great start to your career here, and you're continuing to grow. When you look ahead, whether that's the rest of this season, your career, or even life after baseball, what are some goals you're chasing?
I would say just continuing to be a guy that everyone can, you know, no matter who it is, like friends, coworkers, new teammates, anything like that, being the guy that you can count on for anything, whether it's in game or whether it's outside of baseball, just someone that you can go to and talk to whenever you need to and just ask for help.
Like a rock.
Mm-hmm.
Corbin Smith is a reminder that it's not just about the highlight plays. It's about showing up with energy, taking pride in the details, and being the kind of teammate others can count on. From the outfield to the chalk lines, he set the bar high for what it means to be a star. Corbin, thanks for joining us today and sharing your story. For everyone listening, make winning in life your habit, not your goal. Excellence isn't an outcome. It's a daily standard. Until next time, keep stacking bricks and go Stars.
Coach Cuts Corner is recorded live in the WLNZ studios with Dalian Lowry providing engineering and production assistance. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed today's podcast, please share it and follow us on all forms of social media. Our program has been built and maintained with the help of many great people. If you want to be part of our mission, you can donate using the link in the show notes below. You can learn more at CoachCutter.com and more about our team at LCCStars.com. See you next time.
This is WLNZ Lansing. You're listening to LCC Connect, a weekly program that features the voices, vibes, and vision of Lansing Community College. To find out more about LCC Connect programs or to listen on demand, visit us at lccconnect.org.
LCC
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.